Welcome back to Franchise Festival, where we discuss the history of noteworthy video game series from the last 40 years. In Season 1, we're covering The Legend of Zelda. Last episode, Episode 7, we discussed the rather wretched spin-offs produced for the Philips CDI. But this week, we are moving along to greener pastures, or bluer seas, as it were, with The Legend of Zelda Wind Waker, which was originally produced for the Nintendo GameCube. As ever, I am your host, Christian Skipper. I have with me our usual co-host, Hamilton.
Hello!
And for the Wind Waker, we have with us a special co-host. Could you introduce yourself, Jasmine?
Yeah, hi, I'm Jasmine. I've been playing the Legend of Zelda series basically since I was like 8. So I've played like pretty much all the mainline games. A few of the handhelds, not too many, but yeah, I'm very experienced with the Legend of Zelda.
That's great. And if I understand correctly, you actually have been a fan of the series for longer than I have, truth be told, as I really got into it kind of in the mid-2010s.
Oh, wow.
I'm sort of an out-of-time fan. You know, I had to go back and play through them.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I started playing when I was 8, and that was when I got my first Nintendo, and I got The Legend of Zelda, and we played it to death.
Wowie zowie. Good on ya.
Yeah.
That's... So, that is an obtuse game.
And just so you know, that was back in the late 80s.
So jeez Louise.
That is how long I've been playing Zelda, for over 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is dedication. And what a series to be dedicated to.
Absolutely. It's one of the best. I love the Zelda series.
Yeah, I was really surprised when I came to it. I think the only one that I played contemporaneous with its release was Ocarina of Time. And, like, very briefly, a couple of others. But I was really surprised when I went back in the mid-2010s to to look into its history and play through them. Just how well it holds up.
Yeah.
So to have played them when they came out is something that I wish I had been able to do. But unfortunately, you know, time makes fools of us all.
It does. And, you know, I do have to say, too, that I was able to play all of them pretty much as they came out. So...
Wow.
A lot of my experiences can go right back to, you know, that age when I played them. It was, you know, whatever year, maybe not the year it was released, but definitely
sure.
In that time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all my experience is like built on having played them in order over the years.
Yeah, and there's almost like a sense memory associated with that, like where you were when you first encountered them, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It brings back a lot of memories, for sure. I can remember what I was doing at certain moments. Absolutely.
So this month, we're going to be covering The Wind Waker, and that's actually going to be a two-parter, as we did with Ocarina of Time, just so we can get into some of the nitty-gritty of the dungeon design, since I think it is worth commenting on. More so than some of your kind of by-the-numbers, slimmer Legend of Zelda adventures. To get us started today, though, we wanted to open up the floor for one of our sort of fun, unrelated discussion prompts. And the one for this episode was supplied by Jasmine. So could you ask away?
I was curious, what is your favorite indie game and why?
Great question. Hamilton, you want to kick us off on this?
Sure. Actually, I had a bit of a tough time with this one.
Me too.
I played very few indie games, unlike a lot of people. But the one that's at the forefront of my thoughts was Shovel Knight.
Yeah.
I greatly, greatly enjoyed that game. It was a callback for me to the original DuckTales on the NES, if anyone's old enough to have played that.
Mm-hmm.
I am. But... Very interesting game. Also, for those who are not aware, please look up DuckTales NES Moon Theme.
Best theme ever.
Just do it. You won't regret it. I promise.
Best theme ever.
Moon Theme. Man, Capcom was firing on all cylinders with their soundtracks
oh, yeah.
in the,
they,
the 80s
God.
And 90s.
Oh my, were they.
Good stuff.
But that is mine. How about both of you?
I had a really hard time with this for kind of the opposite reason, which is that I would say a rock-solid 75% of the games that I play are indie games. Since kind of the indie revolution happened in the early 2010s, thanks to, you know, the rise in digital distribution services and everything, I got really hooked on indie games, since they tend to be focused around generally kind of a core set of mechanics, as opposed to your sort of sprawling open worlds and complexity and crafting systems and so forth, which, you know, as we've talked about on the show before, I am not good at games. And so if I can hone in on a single mechanic, I will. So indie games really speak to my particular, you know, my interest in the medium. Funny enough, I'd say that we're still in kind of a golden age, and I'm not sure if we've even hit the peak of it yet for indie games. And so most of my favorites come from the late 2010s. And I hope this isn't kind of a what do you call it, like a presentism bias or what have you. But the years like 2017 to 2019 were really great for indie games. And just to highlight two that came out in that time that really made a mark on me. One is Hollow Knight, which, you know, to continue in our favorite indie games that feature the word knight. Hollow Knight is a really lushly animated 2D Metroidvania. And, you know, indie Metroidvanias are a dime a dozen, I suppose. But I also adore Metroidvanias, so, you know, like, sign me up. Hollow Knight, though, is interesting by virtue of the fact that it's very technical combat is very heavily influenced by Dark Souls, which I'm also a fan of. And it's got this very kind of mysterious, eerie aesthetic set in this sort of fallen kingdom full of bugs. It's on a very kind of micro scale. So the aesthetic really works. The very kind of sparse but beguiling narrative really works. It's got a beautiful soundtrack. It's by, I want to say, Australian developers Team Cherry. And I just adore Hollow Knight. It's a real hoot. It gets a little too hard by the end. And I've only completed about 60% of the game because you only need about 60% to see the credits. And, you know, that was enough for me. As Kenny Rogers said, you know, you need to know when to hold them and when to fold them. And, so I folded them with Hollow Knight and really enjoyed my experience by virtue of that fact. But also to highlight a secondary one, Into the Breach. Which for my money is, golly, maybe one of the top 20 games I've ever played. It's by the same team who made FTL, Faster Than Light, which I am not much of a fan of. But Into the Breach almost plays out kind of like a chess game. It's got sort of roguelite mechanics in that every time you start up a game, it's different. But it's kind of a top-down tactical strategy game, turn-based, where you can see the results of every move that you're going to make, as well as you're told ahead of time what move each of the opponent's pieces are going to make. And so you work through the strategy of how to mitigate risk, which, I don't know, that really speaks to me somehow. It's low-key enough to be relaxing, but also high stakes enough to be exciting every time you play. And every time you play, it's a completely different experience. In that way, I've heard it compared to Tetris, which is a pretty flattering comparison.
Hi, doggies.
Yeah, this is a dog-heavy show. I think Hamilton, how many dogs do you have?
Oh, can you hear them? I have three.
Ham has three. I have two. You will be hearing from my two dogs. They're a Yorkshire Terrier and a Dachshund, which, like, good Lord, those dogs were made to bark.
I have three cats. They're not noisy, but they will get on my lap. So it's like, hi.
Oh, nice.
Hi, kitty.
If we hear purring, we'll know why. So Jasmine, what's your pick for indie game of the podcast?
There's this one game that just really stands out, and it's because I love it and I kind of hate it at the same time. I know that sounds really weird. It's Undertale.
Oh,
yes.
I don't know if you ever played
that.
How
did I forget that?
Oh my I adore gosh, Undertale.
It's so good. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's a work of pure
it's
beauty.
It's genius.
It is so good.
It's a piece of genius. That's why I love it because I love the setting, I love the story, the characters.
I bought their soundtrack.
The music.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, so did yes. I. I bought the game twice cuz I bought it for the PC and then they put out a special edition for the Switch. Mm-hmm. That had the game, had the soundtrack. It actually has like a little locket that's a music box that plays his theme.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Guacamole.
Yeah. It's really awesome. So yeah, and I listen to the soundtrack all the time. It's just amazing. It was one of the games I regret that I can't play again for the first time.
Yeah.
Because once you've played it once, it's like
you kinda know everything.
You know everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
yeah.
So yeah, I really love this game. I kind of hate it because sometimes I feel like the game is a little bit judgy. It judges the player, and I've even seen on Let's Plays, I never did the genocide walkthrough, but I watched other people play it, and the game called me, the viewer, out for watching a Let's Play and not playing it myself.
That's so cool. It's cool.
There is so much in there. He put in, Toby Fox, put in so many... like flags for like the different actions that characters might take. And so the game will really respond to a lot of the things that you do, which is really amazing. I had no idea it had that level of complexity when I first played it. So it's really interesting that the game will respond to, you know, who you kill or who you don't kill or how you talk to people. It's really amazing. I'm not like one of those fans. I feel bad that I have to say those fans.
Right. It's like I said, I'm a fan of Dark Souls. Some games attract a certain toxic fan base culture.
Right. Yeah.
So always going to have the king and or queen of a certain game. I'm just like, okay.
Yeah. Right. It's a drag. I came to Undertale kind of late, maybe circa 2017 or so, after it had had its kind of, its meteoric rise. And I was afraid that the experience would be tainted by how noteworthy it was, but by gum, it was still excellent.
Oh no, I got into it about the same time, actually.
Yeah.
I was totally late to the game, but I went into it knowing pretty much nothing.
I was late too.
Which is how you should play it.
Yeah. I was late to the game, but actually what got me into it was the music. Because I heard a soundtrack from it, just kind of randomly. And I was just like, holy crap, this is really good. And then that's when I looked into the game, and then I saw the story, and it's just like, holy crap, this is really good.
Y'all are making me jealous now. I haven't ever just listened to the soundtrack.
I love the music so much.
You know, I've been working from home lately, as a lot of people have, and so I've been listening to a lot of lot more music than usual, and a portion of that is game soundtracks, and mostly I've been kind of defaulting to, have you ever heard the Snake Pass soundtrack?
I have not.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm.
So it's a David Wise composition, and you know, David Wise is kind of a luminary. He did the soundtrack for Banjo-Kazooie and a few other kind of notable rare games.
Mm-hmm.
But for my money, pound for pound, Snake Pass is just a masterpiece. And so I've been listening a lot to that, and Paper Mario Color Splash, kind of another weird soundtrack that's just amazing. Mm. But I got to get on the Undertale train. I haven't listened to that.
Do
one.
It. That and Sonic the Hedgehog music I've been listening to lately.
Oh god!
Oh heck yeah!
Great.
Love
it.
Those are great.
Yeah.
Love them.
So anyway, moving on to The Wind Waker, it occurs to me to put in a very quick note here, partially because we haven't consistently included this note in earlier episodes, and, you know, I hate for somebody to listen to the podcast and walk away disappointed, but this is a spoiler-heavy podcast, so just be aware that, spoilers abound ahead. Another quick note, just as far as sources for our information go, we covered quite a bit of ground in researching this. Obviously, the Iwata Ask series produced by Nintendo with interviews with original people who created the game was a key source. There was a Nintendo Online Magazine Q&A with Shigeru Miyamoto and Eiji Aonuma in December 2002 that we used for some of the information here. As well as Mark Brown's Game Maker's Toolkit video on the Wind Waker dungeon design, and Chapter 8 of Nicolas Corsier's and Mehdi El-Kanafi's Zelda, The History of a Legendary Saga book, which they created for 3rd edition books. As for the Wind Waker's release, it originally came out on the Nintendo GameCube console in Japan on December 13th, 2002, in North America the following March, in the European Union on May 2nd, 2003, and in Australia on May 7th, 2003. A remake was produced for the Wii U some years later, about 10 years later. That actually originally premiered in North America on September 20th, 2013, in Japan on September 26th, 2013, and then in the European Union and Australia the following October. Only a few days later, truth be told, about a week, on October 4th and 5th. As for the history of The Wind Waker, the original version of it was produced internally by Nintendo, of course, Nintendo Entertainment Analysis and Design, EAD, which is a division that no longer exists, but was responsible for many of Nintendo's biggest hits of the 1990s and 2000s. Even during the production of Majora's Mask, Nintendo EAD had been experimenting with what Zelda might look like on their upcoming GameCube console. So these experiments ended up resulting in the kind of infamous at this point realistic Link video shown at Nintendo's Space World 2000 event. And Space World 2000, for those who don't know, was sort of a trade show that Nintendo held prior to them kind of joining the bandwagon for E3 in the 2000s. So this promotional video was designed to highlight the sort of impressive graphics of their upcoming GameCube console in 2000. The video as a whole is less than a minute long and includes what would end up being a combination of real software as well as tech demos. So these include things like a brief clip of Luigi's Mansion, which would come out in 2001. Not surprisingly, since Luigi's Mansion was very far along at this point, it's pretty representative of the final game. The video also included what seems to be a clip from Metroid Prime, which was being developed by Retro Studios at this point.
One of the best games ever.
Yep.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, Metroid Prime is excellent. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, there were three sort of video sequences featured on the preview reel that were not representative of any final gameplay. The first was Meowth's Party, which is kind of a silly, just sort of a fun CG pre-rendered sequence in which Pokemon's Meowth is playing a guitar and a band on stage. There's a bunch of Pokemon dancing around to it. That would kind of appear in a cut-down form as a video in 2003's Pokemon channel for the Nintendo GameCube, but wasn't ever representative of any game. Super Mario 128, which has gone down in history as the precursor to Nintendo's Pikmin franchise. That involved, not surprisingly, 128 Marios running around on a platform and, getting into all manner of shenanigans. But there was not ever a Super Mario 128 in development. And this leads us, of course, to the Link versus Ganondorf battle. Ganondorf.
Yeah, I heard
this,
that.
Of course, leads us to the Link versus Ganondorf battle. Ganondorf.
He's missing Gandalf's brother. Gandalf's
exactly,
brother.
Yeah. Oh, we found the missing Ganondorf between Lord of the Rings and Legend of Zelda here. Boy, it's too hot in this house.
Oh, no.
Anyway, this clip features really fewer than 10 seconds of a kind of realistically rendered Link and Ganondorf, stylized as they were in Ocarina of Time, engaging in swordplay. And it really wowed the crowd at Space World 2000 and led a lot of fans to believe that this was a preview of an actual upcoming game rather than a tech demo that was the result of a bunch of experimentation by the Majora's Mask team. And would lead to some real hurt feelings down the line, as you'll find out soon. The actual planning for The Wind Waker began after Majora's Mask wrapped development, and certainly long after the completion of the Link versus Ganondorf prototype. Most of the staff on Wind Waker was actually the same as Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. So part of the reason that The Wind Waker would end up taking such a different direction from Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask is that they felt that they had already accomplished what they set out to in that comparatively realistic style, and believed that they couldn't move the series forward without adopting a pretty radical reinvention of how it looked. Development on Wind Waker would take about 2.5 years from its beginning in, give or take, about late 2000. The game kind of coalesced into what would become its final form when a design manager named Yoshiki Haruhana introduced Toon Link early in development. He then brought in a cartoony Moblin character, a very stylized, cartoonish version of a standard stock enemy type that had existed from the earliest Legend of Zelda games. And these two designs would dictate the general direction of the world that was produced by other staff members, including Masanao Arimoto.
Masanao Arimoto. There we go. Okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
So, in addition to this this kind of Toon Link prototype that was introduced by Yoshiki Haruhana, Jasmine had brought to my attention something that I had entirely missed in doing my research for this, which is that character designer Yoichi Kotabe, who had worked at animation studio Toei all the way back from back into the mid-20th century, you know, the 1960s, the 1970s. He'd been picked up by Nintendo in 1985 and produced quite a bit of work there, including illustrations for the packaging of Super Mario Brothers, illustrations for the instructional booklets of Link to the Past and Link's Awakening. He seems to have worked on Wind Waker, and this is a real quirky part of this that I had a hard time validating with credits information, because I can find no credit for him, either at Mobi Games or in the credits of the Wind Waker itself, for having been a character designer on the game. So the strange thing about Yoichi Kotabe is that he was interviewed by Famitsu Magazine, which is, of course, a very noteworthy video games magazine in Japan, and was interviewed on the subject of the Wind Waker, which he is described as having worked on as a character designer. So there seems to be some ambiguity as to what his role was on the Wind Waker in retrospect, but the really interesting part of this story is that he cited as an influence on the Wind Waker, specifically his work on the Wind Waker, but more generally the art design of the Wind Waker, a 1963 Japanese film called, Jasmine, help me out here.
Wanpaku Oji no Orochi Taiji.
Yes. And this, if listeners look up images of this, and we'll link an article related to the subject in the show notes, but it is plainly a precursor to the Wind Waker's style. It's really uncanny when you see pictures of it, the degree to which this single work seems to have heavily, heavily influenced the Wind Waker's art design. I could find no other Nintendo employees talking about this. But Yoichi Kotabe certainly cited it in that Famitsu interview, and, you know, that's good enough for me.
Yeah, I wanted to say real quick
that
Nintendo is famously tight-lipped about a lot of things. So yes. I'm not really surprised that they don't talk about it, because, I mean, this interview was, like, in 2018.
There like, you go,
15 years after the game Wind Waker came out. And it's like, you know, Nintendo does not talk about stuff. So I'm not really surprised that there's not information.
Yeah, now that you mention that, it is worth noting as well, Kotabe was not he was a freelancer following 2007. He was no longer a Nintendo employee after that point. So that may have been a factor in kind of opening up his, you know, his commentary on this. Although he does still do freelance work for Nintendo, so, you know, you don't want to burn your bridges, of course. It's a really interesting kind of side story to this that, you know, I guess we don't know too much about still, but, you know, Lord willing, in some amount of time, the more information about it will come out. But by all means, listeners, we'll post this in the show notes and you too can discover the startling origins of potential origins of the Wind Waker's art style. So this is what would seem to be a pretty rare occasion where the art and world design dictated gameplay in a Nintendo game rather than the other way around. Historically, Nintendo as a studio tends to come up with a key gameplay concept and builds their stories, art design, and characters around that. Most Nintendo games don't even start out as an entry in the associated franchise, but rather start out as a concept that the franchise gets added to with time. This is the opposite of that. So after creating Link and beginning to sketch out the world, the development team settled on creating a series of islands that were separated by a massive sea. And to get between each of these, Link would need to use a sailboat, which he had not used in any previous Legend of Zelda game. To use that sailboat, manipulating the wind was the most logical central mechanic, and this really spoke to producer Shigeru Miyamoto, who'd been wanting to build a game around the concept of wind for a solid decade at this point. He'd been experimenting with wind mechanics as far back as 1986's Super Mario Bros. 2, which would of course be released in North America as The Lost Levels, since we got the rather whimsical turnip-throwing variant of Super Mario Bros. 2. But wind would prove to be a key factor in the Wind Waker. It's even there in the title. And that's in keeping with kind of long-term plans by Shigeru Miyamoto that could only really be realized once Nintendo had gotten around to the hardware of the GameCube console. The very stylized cartoon aesthetic was also useful to the developers in producing better 3D puzzles than they'd been able to create in Ocarina of Time or Majora's Mask, since they didn't need to worry about things like obscuring puzzle components by making rooms seem realistic. They could really kind of play up the angles, play up the colors and all of that sort of thing, and make puzzle designs a little bit more ambitious, since they didn't need to adhere to any kind of realistic appearance. That was followed through with the supporting characters in The Wind Waker, which we're going to talk about in a little bit more depth later on. Supporting characters had started to become a little eccentric in the Legend of Zelda series, with Link's Awakening, as we've talked quite a bit about. But here in The Wind Waker, they really... their visual design starts to match their personality quirks. You get characters that are extremely tall and lanky. You get characters that are have like very strange wide heads and super expressive eyes and zany costumes.
It fits the personality of the character, which is nice if you're not trying to go, as we stated earlier, with like an over like realistic art type. Like someone could have like a giant pot belly and tiny legs, but based on the art style, you could be like, oh, I can see his personality through that.
There's a shorthand to the visual design that's really neat. It lets them, you know, get away with having less dialogue and conveying more of the character through body language and appearance.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say, I was wondering if, like, exaggerated is the word you guys are looking for the character designs.
That's very much the word that I was looking for.
Okay.
Yeah,
I
default to stylized, but exaggerated is a much more, you know, that really kind of pins it down. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really, all of their their kind of visual elements are really exaggerated, you're right. As for the sound design, Koji Kondo, again, was the key composer, though he was augmented by what's been described as 5 or 6 additional composers and technicians involved in the soundtrack. It would be nice to use the credits as a strict representation of who worked on this, but historically that it has proven only part of the story for Nintendo games specifically, but video games in general, due to some kind of, you know, specific conditions in that industry. So, you know, I think we can settle on the fact that there are 5 or 6 additional composers and technicians who helped out Koji Kondo. The soundtrack, again, is universally excellent. We've talked about this certainly with Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, even as far back as... you know, Link to the Past, or the kind of the key theme composed overnight by Koji Kondo for the original Legend of Zelda.
That's right.
It's wild.
That is, that's crazy.
I mean, the man's clearly a genius.
Oh, yeah.
But he turned in another excellent performance with The Wind Waker that it conveys the tone of the game from the opening screen, which we will dub in a clip of here. In the run-up to this game, the promotional period proved to be a real minefield for Nintendo. Early impressions from longtime fans when the game was actually revealed were almost universally negative in the West, because many fans, certainly through viewing this through the lens of still extant message boards, 18 years on, viewed this as kind of a betrayal of the vision originally put forward by the 2000 Space World tech demo. This was not realistic. This did not follow in what fans saw as the increasingly grim and gritty style of 3D Zelda. In fact, it was extremely cartoonish. The fans nicknamed it Zelda due to the cel-shading graphical technique. That graphical technique, just to dwell on it for just a moment, had become increasingly popular right around the turn of the century because it was kind of a low-tech way to produce really stylized, great-looking 3D games without really high polygon counts. So you had things like Mega Man Legends from 1997, Fear Effect from 2000, and Jet Set Radio from 2000, or Jet Grind Radio, if memory serves, for our European listeners. And all of those games had this this style that resembled almost like a comic book or a cartoon, where textures were really bold and colorful and had often like a dark outline on them. So they, in general, the funny thing is they look better in retrospect than games that were made to look realistic at the time. So the folks who were creating this were onto something. That said, that did not mollify fans in the lead up to The Legend of Zelda's Wind Waker's 2003 release. And Jasmine, you actually lived through this. Could you talk about your experience of this for a moment?
Oh, absolutely. I don't remember seeing like the tech demo or anything, but I do remember seeing some of the ads and the hype for the Wind Waker. And I was one of the ones who was turned off. I looked at it and I'm like, what is this? This is not what I was expecting at all. And I remember going to forums and things and people were complaining about it. They thought, oh, this is horrible. This is going to suck. I hate Nintendo forever, you know, like fans usually tend to do.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, the weird thing is they did call it Zelda. I remember Zelda. And, it wasn't even the cell shading that I minded. It was just the cartoonish look. I tend to prefer, me personally, I prefer, more stylized, more detailed artwork. So when I saw this, I was like, what is that?
There's almost kind of like a lowest common denominator approach to it, right? Like, mm-hmm. It almost looks like something produced for like as a children's cartoon,
right?
Back, you know, certainly before people saw all of the complexity of the gameplay and the animations and everything.
Yes.
But when
we
only
saw
it in like still frames,
pictures. And we're like, what the hell is this? And I totally understand the betrayal, because you know, I loved the character designs in Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. I'm an artist, so I tried to emulate them. I tried to learn from them, like, oh, how did they draw, you know, this anime style, you know?
Yeah.
And to see the game just change so drastic, or the series just change into a different style so drastic, I felt a little bit betrayed. I was annoyed.
It's such a 180, right?
It is.
To be fair, I did too. I had kind of the same reaction. I was just like, why would they go backwards?
Right. Make it look, you have the hardware, make it look more beautiful,
right?
not less beautiful.
Right.
I wonder if it's too, because, you know, you have people like me who grew up with the series and we got to, you know, we get used to a certain flow. And you know, when they introduced this cartoony style, it was like, wait, aren't we your fans? I thought, you know, because we were starting, I was an adult. I was like 20, early 20s when this came out. And, you know, it was like, Why are you giving us this kid stuff? We're getting older. The series is getting more mature. Why aren't you maturing with us?
Right.
That's kind of what it felt like.
Yeah, and that seems to me to speak to kind of a broader cultural moment.
Yes.
Around kind of around 2000 with the games medium in general.
Yes, I agree.
Video games had been kind of an adult pursuit back in the 1970s and early 1980s. And then following the crash in 83, they became promoted as a toy for children, beginning with kind of the NES in 1985. and were pretty well promoted as a toy for children, and then with the rise of Sega as kind of a teenager pursuit in the mid-1990s, and then with the PlayStation, we started to get into the realm of, like, these kind of operatic stories designed for, you know, at least later teenagers.
Yes, yes.
And then you get this weird cultural moment in the early 2000s where you have things like Grand Theft Auto coming out on the PlayStation 2. The PC realm moves into just fully straight up, not adult in the sense of scandalous or scintillating or that sort of thing, but very complex stories and so forth.
Right.
And then Nintendo goes in this very different direction of a kind of Disney or Pixar, I don't want to say eternal childhood, but, you know, this sort of out of time vision that did not continue growing with the audience they'd been cultivating.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And this would be a problem for Zelda for the next few years, but it really, it begins with the Wind Waker here.
Yes, yes.
Happily, despite that kind of initial extremely negative reaction, especially in the West, the reaction on the Japanese side was more positive. But more importantly, and I thought this was kind of a neat anecdote provided in the Iwata Asks interview, the wives of Eiji Aonuma and the design manager of the game, Satoru Tazukawa, loved the look of it. They had not previously liked The Legend of Zelda, but they saw The Wind Waker and were very interested in playing it. So the developers got this kind of second wind and thought that maybe they were on the right path with this.
I just wanted to say one really quick thing. I'm actually not surprised at all that Japan liked it better, because they love cute stuff.
That's why a lot of Western stuff doesn't really
mesh
well with their culture too, because it's like big and muscular.
Exactly.
No, they'd rather have it kind of
cutesy.
One of the things that really sold Nintendo on the change to The Legend of Zelda style was that with the new art direction put forth by The Wind Waker, the in-game graphics could finally look like the cover design. And this would continue on into certainly Phantom Hourglass, Minish Cap, Spirit Tracks, not in that order, as it were. But quite a few more Legend of Zelda adventures where, unlike earlier ones where fans would see the cover art and, you know, potentially think, oh, this game is going to look like that. But then, of course, the game doesn't. It's either heavily abstract sprites or, you know, fairly simplistic polygons. In the case of The Wind Waker, the actual in-game graphics resemble the cover art, which was really kind of the, I don't want to say the nail in the coffin, but the final thing that really swung Nintendo's decision-making on this and really made Shigeru Miyamoto happy with it.
Yes, that's interesting. I never thought of that.
Yeah, I was really surprised to read that, too.
Yeah.
The development, despite being about 2.5 years, got pretty rushed towards the end. The GameCube had encountered some sales lags and some software bottlenecks. They didn't have quite enough titles coming out on it, so Nintendo had to push some games out the door slightly earlier than they would have preferred to, and The Wind Waker was one of the consequences of this.
Mm-hmm.
So two dungeons were cut from the game.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about at least one of those. It's really apparent where one of them is cut from the game, and we're going to talk about that in our next episode as we cover the dungeons. But these would go on to be used in later Legend of Zelda games. Happily, the game reviewed very well once it came out. And most fans, though not all, lots of fans revised their opinions of the kind of idiosyncratic visual style once they had the chance to play it. And they got to see the stylized and the exaggerated characters in action. So the game would end up having a pretty positive reputation in retrospect. That led in the 2010s to an HD remake. The HD remake was the product of Nintendo experimenting with converting various Zelda games for its first HD console, the Wii U, around 2012. And so a few of these games that were tested were, of course, Twilight Princess, which we're going to be covering in a few episodes, Skyward Sword, as well as a tech demo that was produced for the Wii U called the Zelda HD Experience from 2011. Surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly in retrospect, given its very exaggerated style, The Wind Waker was the one that adapted best to a major visual overhaul. Aonuma produced it, He had directed the original game. Miyamoto had been the producer on the original. Aonuma graduated to producer for this HD remake. It stuck to the style of the original, but it involved plenty of employees who had not been part of the team who had created the original game. Visually, it's pretty similar to the original. A man by the name of Takahiro Dota was the HD refining program director, which meant that he led the team carrying out reshading of the game, and the shaders were kind of a key part of how this game looks. It somewhat controversially, in retrospect, resulted in the removal of some of the finer points, some of the more exaggerated outlines of the original game's cel-shaded look, in favor of slightly more naturalistic designs. The colors pop more, the lighting is enhanced, the animations are broadly the same, and the team even opted to include like glitches from the original game, but it looks just a bit different, which results in some folks being certainly fans of the original standard definition version and not really appreciating the remake. A few mechanical changes were introduced in the remake, in particular, a late game quest that we're going to talk about in a while was simplified due to criticism of the original game. The two dungeons that had been cut from the original were not added back in. Certainly quite a few journalists asked about this, and it was indicated that moving them back into Wind Waker would ruin the pacing. The concepts for them had been used in later games, so it would end up feeling kind of anemic and not really work in the context of the Wind Waker. So that all, you know, that all shakes out. That makes sense. But the result, of course, is a... before we go on. The last major mechanical change made to the remake, and we're going to talk about some of the more specific gameplay changes later on, but the last major overhaul to it is that the Wind Waker had two screens. It had... not the Wind Waker. The Wii U had two screens. It has a television screen and a gamepad screen.
Yes.
So the inventory could be fully relegated to the gamepad, which alleviates some of the kind of minor mechanical tension where you're constantly going into menus and so forth and looking at maps. So overall, the HD remake from 2013 is an enhanced version in virtually every way, with the exception of some concerns about the visual redesign. All right, Hamilton, well, why don't you walk us through the story of this game?
Sure. So this is the second major appearance of a Zelda timeline where there's actually a sequel, in the sense that like Zelda 2 was a direct follow-up from Zelda 1. And in this case, we decide to have The Wind Waker actually take place 100 years after Ocarina of Time. And there are references to Majora's Mask in this game as well, but it was just a very interesting decision on Aonuma's part to have this as kind of a sequel to the to Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, I hadn't even caught the references to Majora's Mask, and it's not clear at first that it's a sequel to Ocarina of Time, but it becomes clearer later on.
Like, yeah, you'll see as you kind of play the game. I mean, the most obvious one is Ganondorf, because basically how this story goes is that this is not the Hero of Time. I should actually state that out flat out.
Yeah.
So this story involves this incarnation of Link, who's living with his sister Arl and his grandmother, who doesn't have a name, just called Grandma, on an island called Outset Island. I do believe that this is the first game in the series where Link is actually not a predestined hero. He has to earn it by building the Triforce of Courage on his own. But we'll cover that in a little bit later.
Yeah, he's just a kid living on this island.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The island has this kind of interesting tradition of their young boys becoming this kind of representation of the Hero of Time when they turn a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So Link is kind of in line with that transition, but he is otherwise not a noteworthy heroic figure in this game. He's just a kid on an island.
Someone who is actually predestined for evil, Ganondorf, reappears in this game. The Great King of Evil. And he is canonically the same Ganondorf that is from Ocarina of Time. He was sealed in the secret realm, or sacred realm, by the Hero of Time, that Link. And is now trying to, as in most games, acquire the Triforce itself to gain ultimate power. You can probably guess what he's going to try and do with it.
Yeah, as you do. Mm-hmm.
As he do. That's what Ganondorf do. So he broke out of the Sacred Realm, and as Ganondorf does, he was trying to take over the world, wreak havoc, and such. But this time, the Hero of Time did not show up to stop him. It is unknown what happened to him after the events of Majora's Mask. As those who have seen in our previous Majora's Mask, or those who have played it, that Link was searching for his friend, which is commonly assumed to be Navi.
Right.
At the end of the game, he makes friends with the Skull Kid, and then I think he continues his quest, but we don't really know what happens to him afterwards. However, it's obvious that he disappeared. We don't know if he passed away.
He lives out the rest of his days on a ranch.
He lived out his days on a ranch. In either case, he did not show up at this time to stop Ganondorf. So it was up to the king and the Hylian people to save the day, by which they prayed to the goddesses for protection. And they granted that wish by flooding the kingdom entirely, effectively erasing it from existence, which is just told by legends now.
A real monkey's paw kind of solution.
Very much so. Yeah, it definitely leads a very easy way to create a new game. How about that?
Yeah.
And the Hylian people are basically all but extinct, but they aren't quite extinct. In the sense that there are still some people who have pointy ears, and there is the incarnation of Zelda, which Ganondorf is looking for because she holds the Triforce piece of wisdom. So in this game, since the Highlands are all but extinct, Ganondorf has the aid of the giant Helmaric King, which is not the same Helmaric King in the previous games, which kind of look like a giant scorpion, and this one's a giant bird. And he basically says, bring me young girls with pointy ears. So the game kind of starts off actually with the Helmaric King stealing a girl that you don't really know at the time. You just kind of see her get captured. A pirate ship actually shoots at the bird, and because of that, the girl gets dropped. Helmaric King does not see the girl anymore. I'll go into the girl's name, don't worry. And then goes after Link's sister and kidnaps her. Thus, kind of begins the entire adventure. So the girl who was captured let go by the bird, is a pirate by the name of Tetra. So this mysterious girl, I mean, you could probably put two and two together, but for now, we'll just call her the pirate girl, Tetra.
There may or may not be a noteworthy reveal coming later with regard to Tetra's identity.
Indeed. Not that this kind of happened in, like, the original Ocarina of Time or anything.
Uh-uh.
They'd never do it twice.
No.
They wouldn't do that twice. No. You know, this girl's pretty nonchalant. She doesn't particularly care about anybody else. She's a pirate, after all. Yar.
She's so cool. Like, we'll get into it later, but she's very cool.
She is very cool.
She is cool. She has a heart of gold.
Yep.
And after a Rito named Quill says, like, hey, we should probably go rescue the girl, too.
You know, it's worth noting, just for listeners, the Rito are a group of bird people.
Right.
They're a group of bird people. Quill is a postman. So he kind of guilts, basically, Tetra into being like, hey, you should probably help out. So you head up to Ganondorf's fortress to save your sister. The mission, sadly, does not go very well. He's not very well equipped for it. And Link is hurled into the sea, where he is rescued by a talking red boat, which is nicknamed the King of the Red Lions.
Yeah, it's not just any old red lion.
Oh, no. It's the king of them. For those who are not aware, he is a mysterious boat, not just because of the fact that he can talk, but also understands or knows the history of the Master Sword. And he says that you must find the Master Sword to defeat Ganondorf, the Great King of Evil. But to do this, to start off kind of the journey, you have to collect the three goddess pearls, which are named after the three goddesses in Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, our first MacGuffins yes. of the Wind Waker.
Yes, the first yep. MacGuffins of it. It's actually pretty well done. Because most of the world is flooded over, he gives you a baton from the king that's called the Wind Waker, which allows you to control the winds. It is worth noting that the winds do blow naturally, but that makes it awfully hard to travel from island to island. That is your main source of travel. You don't have a pony this time, because you can't swim. And also, yeah, for numerous reasons.
Where's my hippogriff? Where is my water horse?
I'm just saying.
Hippo. Nice.
In a world that has all these fantastical creatures, you can't come up with something that flies. But anyways. So a lot of the novel concept will happen through boats. It's how you can collect treasures. You go to islands and such. That kind of gives you a bit of a traveling adventure experience.
Listeners listening to this should note that between all of these key story beats that we're going to talk about, there's quite a bit of just traveling from island to island to find, you know, fun treasures and maps to treasures that are hidden underneath the water mm-hmm. and so forth. There's quite pieces. A bit of filler here outside of the key story beats.
Right. But for the sake of the story, we'll go ahead and go with where Link needs to go. The first one being the Dragon Roost Isle, which is home to the Rito. And he must retrieve Din's pearl from there. Now, as I stated before, I'll go into a little bit of the history. So the Rito are actually evolved from the Zora.
Yeah.
For those who remember the swimming Zora in Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, in only 100 years, they evolved from another species, which I just love.
From swimming to flying.
Which is weird when you think about it, because it's an ocean. Why would they need to evolve into birds?
It's very silly.
They would be at home in this giant ocean.
It's also very interesting because their deity is the sky spirit Valu, who gives young Rito one of his scales that allows them flight. Without the scale, they cannot get flight, which is part of the problem that's happening on the island right now, is that Valu is acting unpredictable and violent, and they don't know why. But I'll actually go into why the Zora Sky Spirit thing is interesting in a little bit. I'll just touch upon...
Just moving off into the realm of speculation for just a moment here, I suspect the reason why the Rito replaced the Zora is that there already is a mechanic for moving around by water in this game, which is the boat, but there was no mechanic for flying. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect the Zora's evolution to the Rito is... You know, like a lot of Nintendo things, mechanical in origin rather than being, you know, rooted in the story.
I just find it interesting.
That's just my take, anyway.
I just find it interesting that, like, their deity changed, their guardian deity. Because
he's
descendant of Jabu Jabu, but he exists in this game.
Yep,
as we'll find out, yeah. Yep.
So it's like, why did they change it up? Did Jabu just not care anymore?
the change could be a result. To be honest, of a major dungeon being cut, as we'll find out. So it remains to be seen exactly. We don't have hard information on why the Zoras are the Rito, but they are.
So Valu is acting violent. No one's quite sure why. And naturally, I mean, you're the hero of the story, right? So it falls on you to figure out what's going on. You meet up with a young Prince Kamali, who is another Rito. However, he is... He has Din's pearl, but is not really willing to give it up because it belonged to his late grandmother. To help you out, though, you do meet another young female Rito named Medley, who will be important later in the story. And she actually helps you through the dungeon as you get to the source of Valu's discomfort, to put it lightly. The giant Goma in this game, who is less... I would say less spidery, more giant scorpion crab thing?
I don't know what it is. It's weird.
Gore crab.
But he's been biting at the tail of Valu and just causing just general discomfort all around. And once you defeat Goma, you receive the pearl as a reward for saving Valu and... basically ensuring that the rest of the Rito can grow to fly and get his blessing. Din's Pearl. Next up, you head to the Forest Haven, which is where the Great Deku Tree, the next Great Deku Tree arrives. As you might have guessed, I guess the Great Deku Tree has seedlings over the past 100 years that kind of evolve.
Yeah, the Great Deku Tree is back.
He is back. As a young one this time. This time we need to find Furore's Pearl, which will need to be given to him via ceremony. However, this ceremony is blocked because the Korok named Makar was trapped in the Forbidden Woods and needs to be rescued. By the way, some background for the Koroks is that they're actually descendants of the Kokiri from Ocarina of Time.
And the Koroks are these adorable little kind of leaf seedling people. They're mm-hmm. they're very short. They have faces that are leaves, and mm-hmm. a bunch of them have musical instruments.
So as you might expect, Link and Makar have to go to the Forbidden Woods to save him. Once you do so, you're awarded Furore's Pearl, and you move on to the next one. So the last step is to head to Great Fish Isle to get Nehru's Pearl from Jabun, the water spirit. Jabun, like Jabu Jabu many generations before, he's being targeted by Ganondorf, and he actually sealed himself in a cave with a giant boulder that cannot be destroyed by any methods that Link has on his person.
Yeah, you're probably going to need to go through a dungeon here to get that third pearl, just like the first two pearls, right, Hamilton?
One would think, except this time the dungeon is actually a pirate ship, because you have to get to the pirate ship, which is owned by Tetra, interestingly
enough.
Yeah,
it's kind of a series of side quests on the overworld.
Yeah. Now, whether or not Tetra's up to no good or not, hey, she's a pirate, she does her thing. In any case, you need to get there because you need to get the bombs that they have. Thankfully, you overhear two pirates named Gonzo and Mako, respectively, who discuss a password to gain access to the ship, which naturally you get, and you kind of steal the bombs from them that they're planning to use. Using these bombs, you set Jabun free, and he gives you the pearl. Now, herein lies the second part of the quest. And by the way, for those who are listening, you've probably already seen a comparison between like this game and Ocarina of Time. You got your three shiny MacGuffins, and now you're going to unlock the second half of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
In this game, he does not grow up. However, something interesting does happen when he gains all three pearls. He places them on the Triangle Islands that uncovers the Tower of the Gods.
Yeah, kind of in the center of the Great Sea.
Mm-hmm. And the center of the Great Sea hides another secret, which he has to find by going to this tower. He defeats the giant robotic monster, or a guardian called Godan. Very similar to the Bongo Bongo fight, actually. Well, kind of. Similar in look.
Yeah, I've got some thoughts on Godan that we're going to talk about next episode. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, get ready for that, listeners.
Once he does, he earns the right to enter a portal. That Hyrule Castle that has been suspended in time is beneath the waves.
Bum, bum, bum.
Right? One of the very few places that has actually been preserved after Hyrule basically been flooded over completely.
Yeah, and I can't convey enough. This is a heck of a twist in the game itself, in that, you know, you're traveling around what is ostensibly an entirely new world for The Legend of Zelda. Mm-hmm. And it's only at this point when you access the Tower of the Gods and Link heads beneath the waves with the King of Red Lions, that it's discovered that where you've been traveling is, in fact, the mountaintops of Hyrule, and that mm-hmm. The Ocarina right. of Time's Hyrule has been beneath you the entire time.
The entire world you've been sailing is on top of the entire world of Ocarina of Time. It's fascinating. It's also kind of sad, but you also kind of understand why the changes had to happen. When he gets to the castle beneath the waves, he finds the incomplete Master Sword, though he doesn't know that it's incomplete at the time. It's just a Sword of Evil's Bane.
Yeah.
And he pulls up from the pedestal, because that's what he's instructed to do. From here, he returns to the fortress with Tetra in tow to save his sister, and he does defeat the Helmar King this time. However, proves pretty ineffective against Ganondorf himself. Which is kind of confusing, because he has the Master Sword. Why wouldn't he be able to do it? Well, Ganondorf himself reveals that, yes, the sword is a great evil-killing sword. However, it also acted as a seal to Ganondorf's own power. So since Link pulled the sword out, he actually unsealed Ganondorf's power as well.
Yeah, it's kind of a reprise of the putting the sword in the or changing into adult Link in the Ocarina of Time. It's a very similar story beat to that.
Right. Because, like, by putting the sword back in, you kind of seal the events of Ocarina of Time. Ganondorf can't really get his power. But he's still more than powerful enough to overpower Link, which he does.
Yep.
Thankfully, he is saved by Quill and Prince Kamali. And his entire fortress is destroyed in flames by Valu.
Yeah, good riddance.
Very good scene. And no, Ganondorf is not dead, despite what you might hope or think. So the king takes Tetra and Link to the castle beneath the waves once more and tells him a brief history of Hyrule, why it was flooded in the first place, why it was necessary, and also reveals that he is the king of Hyrule. King Daphnis Nohansen. From there, he fuses his fragment of the Triforce of Wisdom with Tetra's fragment, which awakens her power as Princess Zelda, which is the twist. Tetra was Princess Zelda the entire time. And it's in the castle that Link learns that he actually has to find the Triforce Piece of Courage, which he needs to do by finding the fragments of it, which is left by the Hero of Time, wherever the Hero of Time went.
Yeah.
Which again kind of solidifies the fact that this world's Link was not really born as the Hero of Courage. He actually needs to prove himself, basically, by forging the Triforce of Courage and kind of assimilating it into himself. It's very interesting. Before Link can actually do this, though, he actually needs to restore the Master Sword. So to reforge the Master Sword and give it back his full power, Link needs to find two new sages to replace the ones who were killed by Ganondorf, an Earth Sage and a Wind Sage, which will be Makar and Medley, respectively. So, it's interesting to note, listeners, that the previous two sages were actually one from the Kokiri tribe and one from the Zora tribe. And they were killed prior to the events of the Wind Waker. So, that kind of leads one to assume that this probably happened back in the time of when the Hero of Time existed. Which is very interesting, because it also kind of leads to where the other sages go. But at least in this game, we have at least the Earth and the Wind. There probably were the other sages, but maybe those are cut from the dungeons. So we'll just go with those two for now. So to make Makar and Medley the new awakened sages, they have to go to the Earth and the Wind temple and defeat the bosses there, which we'll go into who the bosses were a little bit later. Once you beat those two dungeons, and those two awaken, they do indeed allow you to get the true Master Sword back. Once you do that, you find the fragments of the Triforce pieces, which are actually underneath the ocean. Once you get the fragments back, he becomes the official owner of the Triforce Piece of Courage, and is officially dubbed by the king the Hero of the Winds. It's a very cool title, in my opinion. This is kind of the point where Link has pretty much gained as much power as he will. So we're going to lead into the final battle. What we do learn, however, is that during the time that Link was adventuring, he actually kidnapped Princess Zelda.
Of course.
Dang
it.
And took her beneath the waves. So Link has to prepare for going to Ganondorf's tower beneath the waves to rescue her and hopefully seal him once and for all.
Spoiler alert, it's not once and for all.
Cough, Twilight Princess, cough.
Yeah, right?
Right.
But the Legend of Zelda series ended in 2003. No, just...
So you head to Ganondorf's tower, and you have to scale the castle as Link, fighting a giant marionette of Ganondorf, actually. So once you beat him, you get to Ganondorf proper. He gives you kind of the spiel of villainy. Like, this is what I intend to do. I'm evil. I want to take over the world. But one thing I found very interesting is that besides the evil speak, he also talks almost in a like a lamenting tone of what happened to Hyrule.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's not kind of the evil psychopathic Ganondorf in the first game or the one from Twilight Princess. He actually kind of shows almost an aged wisdom of someone who's just like, yeah, I'm evil, but also, wow, all this stuff happened and I kind of remember it. And how odd it is that it's happening this way.
This is rough. This is really the only kind of sympathetic portrayal of Ganondorf I think the character would receive throughout the series. And sympathetic is kind of going a little too far. But yeah, there is something to be said for the writing of Ganondorf here, explicating a little bit on why he's doing what he's doing beyond just being a sinister jerk.
Yeah, that's true.
It's kind of the
talking
first...
about the way he's been kind of marginalized.
It's kind of the first game where it kind of like gives him a bit of background, which in my case is, in my opinion, it's great, but also kind of odd in the sense that just like, okay, so in this game, it's he almost kind of like wants to rule the world because he wants to create order. Like he believes that like his way of ordering is the way that like the world should function. Because, like, people don't really know how to rule themselves, and they're kind of chaotic anyway. And it's just, like, it's very fascinating because, like, they completely give this up in later incarnations of Ganondorf, where he just busts loose and just tries to destroy the world. But this one actually kind of shows someone who gained wisdom through 100 years. Like, I'm actually going to do something to change the world. And yes, I'm still evil, obviously, but, like... here's kind of a method to my madness.
Yeah, this is almost the high watermark of Ganondorf in that the series pretty well moves on from him past this point. He does appear in later Legend of Zelda games, but he tends to be a secondary antagonist.
Yeah.
After a first antagonist. This is really kind of the most text-heavy version of Ganondorf.
Like, I admit from a storyteller standpoint that I was a little bit disappointed that they kind of cut off this kind of aged, learned Ganondorf. I mean, like, he also doesn't overstay his welcome as someone who just, like, explains his reasoning. He doesn't, like, go into this long 2-hour spiel as to, like,
how... Yeah, you're not sitting there, like, sympathizing with Ganondorf, yeah.
Right. It just adds depth that is just interesting to me. But kind of going more back into the story of things. So after he kind of, like, tells you what he wants to do, you try to fight him one more time. Which does not end well, because he's still very powerful. Once he actually defeats you, or overpowers you, he intends to use Zelda's piece of wisdom, your piece of courage, and his piece of power, and actually does create the Triforce. I think this is actually the closest that Ganondorf actually ever really gets to winning.
Yeah.
To be perfectly honest. Like,
yeah, it looks pretty bleak there.
Yeah. Like, this is the first game where he has the Triforce in his hand. Like, it's done. However, he is interrupted by the king, King Daphnis, who actually touches the Triforce before he does. And he just wishes for it to be done. He's like, I want myself and you and Hyrule to just be buried forever. No more suspension in time, no more nothing. It's the end of an era. This needs to all end and create a real, actual future for the generations that are growing up. Which I also found very... moving.
Yeah, there's some interesting subtext with King Daphnis here.
I just find the fact that, like, I mean, I think he was willing to sacrifice himself from the start, but they're basically saying, like, we don't need to create more sequels to Ocarina of Time. Like, this is done. But also in the sense that just, like, Ganondorf is this shadow from history. And he just won't leave. And now it's just like time's like, no, it is time to get rid of you once and for all. It's time to create something new. This world is changing. This is not Hyrule anymore. This is not Ocarina of Time. You are allowed to evolve beyond this. And it's kind of funny because, like, this is my problem because I like to overanalyze things. I feel like this is kind of like the way that, like, even the producers are just like, hey, I know we went in a new direction, but isn't it good? This may not be what you're used to, but things can evolve, and this is still a great experience. So just, like, what you knew of old can become something greater. And I'm just like, huh, I wonder if they did that intentionally.
Yeah, very Metal Gear Solid 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's neat. That's not a reading I'd considered, but yeah, it's kind of like, you know, we don't need to repeat the past. We can create something
new. Right, they can create something new and just as good.
Huh.
Or even better. It's like, I know that you wanted this to be Ocarina of Time 3, but, like, hey, try this new art direction. But again, I could be completely wrong. I don't know any sources that would verify that. I just kind of...
No. I mean, it's death of the author, right, man? You know, it's whatever you're interpreting it to be. And it's kind of neat it's kind of wild that they would put that at the end.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I like that. I hadn't thought of that interpretation either. I think that's really good. It almost seems to be saying mm-hmm. that.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd never even consider that, but I think there's a lot to that.
Because they knew the people who are talking about the game and just, like, the problems they had with it and the different art style and stuff like that. You knew through development and people finding out that just, like, this is what you're going to make out of this series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the negative reception that it received among Western fans was well ahead of it being completed.
Right.
So they could certainly have built that into the game.
Yeah.
So what happens to Ganondorf, Hamilton?
So
how's this confrontation shake out?
I will say predictably he lost, but unpredictably it was a fantastic fight. This is definitely one of my absolute favorite Ganondorf fights, besides the one in Twilight Princess. Even though I don't like the character of Ganondorf in Twilight Princess, because I find him very boring in one note. Sure. I do enjoy the fight there, but this one, oh man, he's just a two-sword style fighting against Link and Princess Zelda helping out by shooting light arrows. Beautifully choreographed. And you can cheese this fight, but don't. My recommendation to those who will play it or are just interested in playing it, don't cheese this fight. Play it real, because the choreography is beautiful. You're running rings around him. He's attacking you. It's prompting you to do all these acrobatic attacks against him. It's a very... Not to mention, in the background, you see the flooding of Hyrule happening around you.
It's super cool.
It's just a beautiful, beautiful final fight. But as I said, predictably, through the course of it, you do end up beating him. By which you end up jamming the Master Sword into his forehead.
It's bonkers. Like, it is... It is spectacularly violent imagery for Legend of Zelda.
It is, which is interesting because he lives through it. He just turns to stone. Like, he's just sitting there kind of remarking. And again, from a storytelling narrative, I'm sorry, people, this is what I like. But it's like, he's basically like saying like, this is how it ends. He's basically, again, lamenting that things are happening this way. Also, there's a scene where after King Daphnis basically wants to flood the world, and Ganondorf just starts laughing.
That's right.
Laughing at the hopelessness of the situation. His desires, his goals, his motivations just shattered before him. He gets nothing now. Everything that he ever wanted is being destroyed in front of him, and he does nothing but just laugh at his own helplessness. I'm sorry, but I love that.
It's great. Ganondorf's demise in this has some real, like, Roy in Blade Runner energy about it.
You could easily just have him do the whole spiel of just like, how dare you, Link? You destroyed everything. I will destroy you because I'm evil. But no, he actually has like a human moment of just like, I have nothing now. This is hilarious. But anyways, going back to the story, he encases him in stone, and then you bid King Daphnis farewell, because that was kind of his desire as well. He wanted you all to become a new generation and grow with the changing world. And you are risen to the top. You reunite with Tetra's pirates, or I guess Zelda's pirates now, your sister. And it kind of ends on that note. There is after scene credits where you see other characters, but that's basically the end of the game.
So we covered Link, we covered Ganondorf, we covered the King of Red Lions pretty extensively. But I thought it might be worth discussing here for a moment Tetra and Zelda, who form kind of a key part of the story here, but introduce some really kind of problematic elements to the game. Did you want to take the point on that, Jasmine?
Sure. Sounds good.
Yeah, so hit us up.
Okay, so when you first meet Tetra, she's really assertive, really independent. She's got her own mind. She's sassy. She doesn't you know, she doesn't, oh, how do you put this? She's total tomboy. So, and then, so you're like, okay, cool. You go with Tetra. And then there's this big reveal. Ooh, she's Princess Zelda. And it's like you like, I don't know, you were saying earlier, but yeah, she totally turns into this like cute, like soft-spoken princess type. Not even, and she like, I don't even know, where did she get the clothes from? And the
right, and this, just appears,
this, like magic.
Yeah, she just kind of transforms.
Dragon Ball Z clothes beam.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, I'm a princess now. You know, she never complains. She never goes, "What's this dress stuff I've never worn? You know, what is this?" Oh, and then she's expected to hide because, of course, mm-hmm. Ganondorf knows who she is, so he's looking for her. And she never once, I mean, she never complains. She never says boo about anything. She's like, oh, okay, I'll just hide down here while you guys go save the world. Yeah. I mean, I was doing all this stuff before Link showed up. I mean, because it kind of looks like it, I think. She's mm-hmm. if you look in her cabin, she's got like a picture of the Triforce. And I can't remember what other stuff she has, but she's definitely kind of, it looks like she's kind of been doing some stuff behind the scenes, maybe. And then Link shows up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's definitely been doing this a lot longer than Link has.
Yes. And then Link shows up and she kind of is like, oh yeah, here, you do some stuff too. And, you know, and then like when she turns into the princess, it's like, oh yeah, I'll just sit here and wait for you. You know, all of that independence and assertiveness that she had is just completely gone. It's completely wiped away. And I have found that personally really disappointing, even as a young 20-something-year-old. I was like, really? What the hell?
Yeah, it just took me aback because it was just so sudden.
Yeah,
there's no reason for it.
No, not at all, other than she's supposed to.
Right.
It's a real drag. It reminds me, for all the world, all I could think of, and, you know, maybe this will date me or make something of a fool of me, but, you know, I have a strange affection for the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer Christmas special.
Yes.
And, like, this thing is, it's a disaster through 2020 eyes, or frankly, like, 1970 eyes.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, yes. It's profoundly backwards in some of its messages. You know, I have a certain affection for it because my family watches it every Christmas, and you know, we all get a good laugh out of how awful it is and ridiculous, and like how cute the animation is. You know, it's a complex piece of media, but there is one of the like the bleakest kind of weird mid-century misogynist messages about halfway through that movie, where Rudolph's father goes out with Rudolph because and leaves the women reindeer in the cave because, quote, this is man's work.
Oh, God.
The lady reindeers have to stay in the cave. And, like, all I could think of while playing Wind Waker, where Link and the king tell Zelda to stick around under the waves while they go accomplish the quest, is like that mm-hmm. scene from a mid-1960s Rankin-Bass special.
Right.
And like, that's not a good thing to be in a 2000s video game.
No.
It's a real drag. It really undermines the entire character of Tetra that has been built up throughout the game.
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, Zelda's just supposed to be like a different... She's supposed to be the damsel in distress. Like, that's considered better.
Exactly.
Like, you're not supposed to like...
Yeah, that is the archetype of that character.
You're not supposed to, like Tetra for Tetra. Tetra is supposed to be very different than Zelda, where Zelda is dainty and proper and mm-hmm. pretty.
Princessy.
Yeah. And then Tetra's just, like, this weird...
Yes.
Gross, nose-picking tomboy. Just like...
Right?
You're not supposed to like that.
And then I feel like this all gets, like, very interestingly complicated by the fact that Zelda becomes Tetra at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, she, like, turns back.
Yeah, like, which...
Okay.
I was really, like, I was really bummed about this, and I think there is a lot to be bummed about with it. And then also I thought it was kind of a surprising inversion that at the end of the game she returns to being Tetra and remains Tetra for the two sequels to Wind Waker that we're going to be covering sometime later.
Mm-hmm.
Tetra functionally outlasts Zelda in the Wind Waker story.
See, I haven't played those. I didn't play...
They're not those great.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I haven't played those handheld games, so I can't say anything on what happens there.
But you know what I...
And it's not germane to the story here either. Like, okay. We need to regard this as right. A specific piece of media, not with the right. lens of what came later.
And yet, right. Do you know what narratively I like about this? And I'm going to sound completely weird for saying this. Is that, again, I think it goes back to the king basically saying, like, you guys need to, like, evolve on your own and, like, create a new generation. Like, you don't need to be this Princess Zelda anymore. Like, this is not you. So she goes back to being Tetra, just like, this is you. Like, this is who you are meant to be. This is a new generation. Like, now, do they mean to do this? Oh, probably not.
Yeah, I don't know.
To a certain perspective.
And there's kind of like some weird, vaguely patriarchal overtones to that, too. You know, the idea that, like, it's through his efforts. I don't know.
That everything kind of happens.
Oh, yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I see that.
I mean, it was kind of the one thing with, like, I mean, it's the same thing with, like, Ocarina of Time, which I really was annoyed with. Like, Sheik was just a freaking cool character.
Yeah, Sheik, exactly. This is exactly the same thing.
Is awesome. And then it becomes Zelda, and Zelda is...
Kidnapped. Boom.
She gets kidnapped, barely helps, screams after everything happens. Like, that's not who she's presented herself to through majority of the game.
Right.
Yeah.
Even the beginning of the game, she was very bravely, I think, spying on freaking Ganondorf. He's a king of evil. And he was just like, she's like, no, I'm going to like find out what he's in and then stop him. Like, yeah, you go, girl. It's like, what happened?
I wanted to comment on one more thing about Tetra Zelda. Tetra is darker skinned. You may have noticed.
Oh, I was I was hoping you'd touch on that, but I was going to let you do it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is so problematic. It makes me livid, actually. Yeah, and then when she becomes the princess, her skin magically lightens to a lily white. And like, really? Nintendo, what the hell are you thinking? That is so racist. What, a princess can't have darker skin?
Now she's lighter. And don't give me this whole, like, she would have gotten a tan because everyone would have had a tan.
Right?
It's like, don't even try that crap. Now she's pure and lily white. She has the light arrows. I was just like, oh, come on. So I guess Tetra used the dark arrows? Like, come on.
Yeah, there's some real kind of colorism at work here with,
with the
Tetra Zelda thing.
And I always hated that. It always pissed me off. It's very obnoxious.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you if it's a cultural thing. I mean, I'm sure Japan has colorism exactly like we do, exactly like India does, exactly like all these other countries do. So it probably has something to do with that, but it's no good. No bueno.
I mean, I've heard and seen, and forgive me for those who could correct me, but apparently Japan can be fairly racist.
Yes, they can.
It's a real, like... It's a real problem.
It is. Yeah. It is.
It totally is.
So it's just like, but I mean, Tetra's character on herself, if she just remained that character,
right?
No problems. Like, she should have been awesome. Cool. Yeah,
she is. She's awesome. I liked her.
Yeah, as a bit of a spoiler for later in the season when we're covering spin-offs, we're going to tackle Hyrule Warriors. Which,
oh, yes! Oh, I love Hyrule Warriors!
maybe we'll get you back for that one, Jasmine. Hyrule Warriors,
this is the best game ever.
A lot of... I don't want to say this gets resolved with Hyrule Warriors, but Hyrule Warriors treats its characters, in some ways, with a little bit more respect.
It does. It does better than Nintendo does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
to be honest.
Weirdly,
and
Was
it Team Ninja that developed it? And they did Other M, which was garbage.
Other M? Ugh. No me gusta.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Hyrule Warriors, they treated their women with a lot of respect. I really liked...
Yes.
And there's problematic elements, to be sure.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Sia is... really problematic, and I don't like her outfit, but really, they did a really great job. I mean, they gave Zelda like all this agency, and she's allowed to fight, and she's awesome, and she has several weapons. Even she's really cool.
Yeah,
and you can fight as Tetra. They have Tetra in there, So anyway,
play Hyrule Warriors, listeners.
Mm-hmm. I love Hyrule Warriors.
So with regard to minor characters in this game, and, you know, I don't know if certain listeners like myself might regard this fellow as a more major character, but Tingle returns in Wind Waker after his debut appearance in Majora's Mask and his reprises in the Oracle games.
Canonically, apparently, he is the same age that he was in Majora's Mask, which is 35 years old.
Yeah, I think once we move into this realm, we're moving into the realm of the fact that the Legend of Zelda series isn't really on a strict timeline. Like, Tingle here is simply the character of Tingle from Majora's Mask.
He's a god.
Tingle's a real weirdo. And he appears in this game in a very strange guise where he has his own island, and he has, if memory serves, its cousins. It's other Tingles, or yes, other people that look like him but wear gray tunics, working for him, operating heavy machinery on his island.
Yes.
In the original game, he offers an item called the Tingle Tuner. In the HD remake, he... right, exactly. It's this kind of Game Boy Advance-esque tool. Basically, his function... plot-wise in Wind Waker, in as much as one can call it that, is to kind of translate Triforce maps so Link knows where to find the Triforce, and he does it at an exorbitant cost. So it's kind of in keeping with his map functionality from Majora's Mask. You know, that's more or less Tingle's role in this game, but man, I can't get enough Tingle.
You know, I didn't mind him in Majora's Mask. I thought he was okay. He was a little goofy. I'm like, okay, whatever. I did kind of like his silly little...
Kululimpa? You
know, Tingle, Kululimpa. These are Tingle's magic words. Don't steal them. I thought that was kind of charming and cute. And then I feel like, honestly, Nintendo shoved Tingle down our throats.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I just feel like because they did that, I don't like him... I don't think he's as cute or as funny or as interesting as Nintendo seems to think he is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what's frustrating for me. I mean, they give him this, relatively large spot in Wind Waker. And it's like, why is this guy here? He's so weird.
Yeah, he's actually more essential in Wind Waker than he was in Majora's Mask.
Actually, he is. You're right.
Which is weird because it's like in Majora's Mask, it made sense, I guess, that he was there because the game was kind of a dreamscape in general. Kind of.
Right.
Like a hallucination-ish thing, like built up by the Skull Kids. So whether he existed or not, whatever. But it's just like to have that exact Tingle, like in Majora's Mask, it's like it would have been better if he was a like an Easter egg. Like, you found him somewhere, and he's like, lol, oh, he's there. What an interesting thing. But to like have him as, like, a prominent-ish character, I'm just like, that's not necessary. He wasn't that great.
Right, he wasn't that great. He was amusing as a one-off character, and they keep bringing him back, and it's like, hey, he's not that funny. I don't think he's that interesting. And they forced me to play him in Hyrule Warriors 2. And I didn't like that either. He's terrible. Yeah. Anyway, I'll stop ranting.
No. Tingle's a real piece of work, and you're right to dislike him.
He is funny. I do think he's funny at times. It's just sometimes he's kind of annoying too. It's like, okay, enough with this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of wonder what the deal is, right? Like who was really kind of pushing for Tingle over there at
at Nintendo? I have an analogy. Sorry.
Yes, tell us.
He's like the Jar Jar of the Zelda
series. He is, yes.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah.
Sorry, shots fired.
Well,
yeah.
But even Star Wars had the intelligence to like basically kill off Jar Jar.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, why didn't Tingle become background. A senator?
He runs Naboo.
So we got the fishmen as well. These are kind of a gameplay function. They tell you information about the islands that you visit, sort of these cryptic clues as you throw fish food into the water, if you approach them as they're jumping up above the waves. I find these guys endlessly charming as well.
They call you Small
just
Fry.
Very quirky.
Yep.
Yeah, hoy, Small Fry.
Hey, fry.
Small Fry.
Eventually.
Yeah, a Beetle. Beetle makes his first appearance here. Beetle is a merchant who runs a ship that travels around the seas in Wind Waker, and he would appear in quite a few other Legend of Zelda games. I hope we can dub in an audio clip here. He likes to thank Link at the end of their
thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
I have him all memorized. Oh my, I'm really good at mimicking stuff, so it's like, yeah, it's what was it? Bye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Little sayings and thank you. God.
Yeah.
he's a goof. I like him.
Yeah, Beetle is kind of a dark horse favorite of mine.
Yeah.
Link's grandmother appears here. She is one of a very small number of familial relations that incarnations of Link has.
Right.
The only other ones that I can think of are Link's uncle in Link to the Past.
Oh, right.
Mm.
Right.
But thankfully in this game, the grandma actually lives.
Well, right, yeah. Link's uncle, that's a real... I stand by the fact that Link's uncle survives based on the end credits, but that is not... That's not a universal...
I think you guys talked about this, too. You did.
Yes.
But when Link makes his wish in Link to the Past, I thought he wished for everything to go back to the way it was.
Oh.
So, I thought, that that would make sense why his uncle came back, because, like, oh, it's before Ganon did all the bad stuff.
Mm.
You know, I wish that Ganon had never done whatever it was, you know, he'd never touched the Triforce, he'd never corrupted the Sacred Realm,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, et cetera. You know, I wish that everything would go back to normal, maybe.
Hmm.
I am going to reveal myself as not the best close reader, but I don't even remember Link making a wish, so your reading of this seems extremely plausible, and I might have just breezed past it.
He didn't. It's never shown. What is shown is when the Triforce talks to him, it says, you know, now touch the Triforce with a wish in your heart.
Oh.
I played that game obsessively, so I have that one absolutely memorized.
So, you know, I've only finished it the one time, and it was for this show.
Kind of same.
So that's personally what I think happened. I think, and that's why you see, like, you know, the girls, the maidens, the descendants of the sages are back.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the bully and the roly-poly guy
mm-hmm. yeah.
you met in the Dark World? That's why they're back to normal.
Holy mackerel.
And all that stuff. That's what I think.
Resurrection.
That is fascinating. I had not even considered that, but it would explain why Link's uncle pretty clearly dies and then living in the end credits.
Yes.
Wow.
Exactly.
Good call. Yes. I had not even thought about that.
Yeah.
So yeah, Link's grandmother mercifully does not need to be resurrected. She just lives out her days peacefully on Outside Island.
Although, listeners, if you're... if you care about good old grandma, there is some kind of, like, medicinal herb you have to give her later on, because she, like, gets, like, super upset that your sister got taken and then you left as well.
Right. You have to give her a fairy.
You have to give her a fairy. So, yeah. You've got to heal her. So if you're going to play this game and you care about grandmothers, just do that.
Yes, give her the
just
fairy.
Just do it.
Yep.
I skipped right past this subplot.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And then she gives you this really awesome soup
it's so
that
good.
Acts like a blue potion.
Yeah,
I'm not a great
and
grandson,
there's two servings.
It is two servings, and it's health and magic, so it'll help you.
Oh, wow.
Yes. It's like a blue potion for free.
Yes. It's so good.
But you can only carry one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I really should have stuck around on Outside Island a little more. Played with those pigs. We've also got Tot the Elvis impersonator. This fellow appears on Windfall Island, and he's, I don't know, he's a real side character, but we're kind of getting into the kooky side characters here. He dances around and teaches you a song that lets mm-hmm. you, alter the time of day.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's a real goofball.
He is.
A person who I have here in the notes as Boat Game Dude, Salvatore. Golly, Salvatore is the heart and soul of Wind Waker for me. He runs a game where he holds a board up in front of his face that lets him pretend to be different people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And lets you play a variant of Battleship.
Yes.
for the Wind Waker. And I should note, just Spencer, our erstwhile co-host, is here in spirit. He did provide an interesting video that explains the trick to winning the battleship game. I had thought that it was entirely random, but there is a trick to it. But yes, Salvatore's...
That game's a butt.
I know, and I love it.
I mean, the game, but it's a butt if you want to get the heart piece.
It is, yeah. And I got into a real rut where I played it for about an hour because I guess I just love Battleship and didn't have a more readily accessible Battleship variant. but yeah, Salvatore's sound effects really make it work. Sploosh and all that. Boom, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's the best.
Just ask me to do all your sound effects. I'll do them.
We should.
I do all sorts of sound effects. I'm a goof.
You're like a full-time Foley professional here. we have Tetra's crew, who, as we discussed earlier, this is a crew of pirates who are revealed to, in past lives, have been Princess Zelda's retainers in a real, not well-hidden, but... You'd only really notice it if you looked around at the environmental details in Hyrule Castle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, easily missable. That's the best way to put it. The Gorons, who...
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are broadly gone from the world of the Wind Waker, with the key exception that they do appear as hooded wandering merchants.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who are pretty hard to find. Actually, when I was playing through the HD version for this this podcast, I never encountered one. I've encountered them on previous playthroughs, but I didn't this time. I think that's all the minor characters that I had to note here. Did anybody else have any other minor characters to note? Because there are plenty.
I just had one quick thing to say about the Gorons.
Yeah.
If you remember from Majora's Mask, when you turn into the Goron, you can't swim in water.
Yeah.
Right? You immediately, it's like you drowned, right?
Yep.
So I imagine since it's all ocean, there's no Gorons because, they all drowned.
That's too sad. They should have tried to jump into water and instantly reappeared back on land like they did in Majora's Mask.
Right. I'm imagining just the collective sound effect.
They just try to jump in and they go,
it just echoes through the entire planet.
Oh, mercy. I didn't even think about it. It's like, oh no, they're all dead. Oh my god.
Yeah, a lot darker in retrospect.
I like the Gorons. I think they're terrible.
I do, yeah. They're wonderful. Yeah.
You know where their name comes from, right?
I don't know. Tell us.
Goro comes from Goro Goro, which means it's a sound
effect. Oh, for rumbling or rolling.
Oh.
Yeah.
Rolling.
Like the rolling.
I had no idea. Nice.
So, yeah, that's why they're called Gorons.
Cool. Did we have any other minor characters to note? You had the teacher person. Oh my goodness. I can't let this pass by. There is a butler who is also a door.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I love the door butler. He feels like something out of Majora's Mask. He's so intensely surreal.
Mm-hmm.
He's a door that will not let you pass unless you've proven that the house's owner has given you permission. If you talk to him while you're in the house and there's some specific condition, he comes to the melancholy conclusion that he is a door and is sad about it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's some top-notch
something
writing.
Like that. Yes.
Yeah. I love Door Butler.
Yeah, he's interesting. Don't touch me with those filthy hands. Ah.
And that just about wraps it up for our first episode on The Wind Waker. We are again going to be covering this as a two-part series. Next time, on June 15th, in episode 9, we're going to be covering its kind of rough gameplay outline, as well as working our way through each dungeon in the game, talking about things like bosses and tools and so forth. So we hope you will join us for our return to the Great Sea next time. This has been your hosts, Christian.
And I'm Hamilton.
I'm Jasmine.
if you would like to look up some previous episodes or check out the Franchise Festival article series, which covers other video game franchises, you can visit franchisefestivalpodcast.com or reach out to me on Twitter at the handle at singinbreakman. And of course, at the website, we'll have things like show notes, we'll have links that we referred to in here, and some interesting sources for you to check out. So please go there and let us know what you think. Goodbye.